The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Okay, let's talk about the occasion for the writing of the gospel. And here again, by the way, we're normally quite dependent on internal evidence which has to be interpreted, inferred in some way, because none of the writers of the New Testament begins by saying, okay, let's summarize what's been going on and what's motivating me to write at this point. You get very close to it, you know, with 1 Corinthians, where Paul tells you, you know, close family has given me this report and answering your letter. But usually you don't have even that luxury. In the case of the Gospel of John, he tells us nothing about his own situation as the author, and certainly the book of Acts has nothing about that. We get a little bit of information from the early tradition, but it's a little sketchy, and you're not always sure how accurate it is. But you may want to think of identifying the occasion of a document as kind of a subset of identifying the purpose. There is usually some kind of general, distinct goal in mind, but there may be secondary factors motivating the author to write. Now, what I would like to do is to review very briefly some inferences that have been drawn from the gospel material, particularly in the last few decades. I think last time I mentioned the work of J. Lewis Martin, who presents chapter 9, The Healing of the Blind Man, as really reflecting a late first century set of problems. And Lewis Martin was Raymond Brown's colleague at Union for many years, and there was some interaction between them. And Raymond Brown, after he had completed his two massive volumes in John, he began to pay a little bit more attention to this issue of what may have been the first century setting of the author and of the community that he was a member of. And I remember very distinctly his giving a paper at SBL, I think it was in the early 80s, it may even have been his presidential address, in which he came up with this incredible recreation of the groups that the author of the Gospel of John was having to deal with. And it caused quite a bit of, there was a lot of talk about it. Some people very excited. It was almost 99% hypothetical and speculative, but it was so beautifully done. And then this material eventually came out in his book, Community of the Beloved Disciple. And the very title, you know, is quite indicative of the shift in interest in scholarship. It's not Jesus, you know, it's not even the Apostle John, but it is a community, the Johannine School or the Community of the Beloved Disciple, whatever, that people are beginning to really be interested in. Well, for all its speculation, I think Brown's synthesis can serve us well as a hypothetical framework, which we can test as we go through the gospel, if you will. You always have a hypothesis, whether you're conscious of it or not. So this is going to be the hypothesis. Got to be careful not to let the hypothesis force you to filter everything that you're reading. But you can test from the text itself whether there's anything to it. In his view, the gospel and also the epistles of John, are the product of a well-defined, and that's key here, it's a well-defined Christian community. And that community happens to be in interaction with, and he identifies, six different groups. And he even has a chart which canonizes the whole thing and whatever. Six distinct groups. Number one, John or whoever the author is, or authors, have to deal with other Christians, that is, Christians that are identified with the apostolic churches more generally. Now, right off the bat, you see that there is a certain construct here. There is a category of early Christians which are more or less tied to the apostolic age, presumably the churches founded by Paul and Peter and so on. This community of which the author of John is a part is distinct from that. And the author of the gospel views these other Christians as not too bad. But their problem is that their Christology is not quite as high as it ought to be. Nevertheless, they're close enough that the Johannine community desires unity with them. And that supposedly is reflected in chapter 17 when Jesus prays that they may be one, you know, there may be unity and so on. So there's some kind of division or at least a sense of distinction. And the Johannine community has some misgivings about other Christians because they don't have as clear understanding of the deity of Christ, you see, or his pre-existence or whatever. And nevertheless, they don't want to antagonize them. They feel that there is enough common ground to be united. So there's kind of an ecumenical sidebar, if you will, going on here. Incidentally, you know, Bob Gunder, who's going to be speaking next Friday, a week from tomorrow, and we were on the phone, and he was asking me, you know, whether I should do this or the other, and I suggested that he choose the more provocative title, and he's going to talk about this, which is really a very difficult problem, one that evangelicals, I think, need to address a little bit more directly, because mainstream scholarship pretty much takes it for granted that you have a variety of theologies within the New Testament, and particularly a variety of Christologies. And typically, you know, the Gospel of John is seen as having a higher Christology than other parts of the New Testament, and so on. So he's going to address that topic a week from tomorrow at 2 o'clock in room 3. So he's a very fine speaker and a superb scholar. When we were together at Westmont College, we used to have these little cubicles in the library. I mean, these were real kind of small cubicles right there in the middle, and the faculty were allowed to have these, and his cubicle was next to mine, and I would sit there, and I wouldn't hear anything, but every time he came out of the cubicle, he had a stack of stuff that he had produced, I was always very intimidated, thinking, you know, I'm not getting anything done, and this man next door is just, you know, writing volumes of stuff. But anyway, that's a plug for next week's lecture. So Christians of apostolic churches generally is one group. Second group is Jewish Christians who have a few more problems. They are part of the church, I suppose, but they're distinct from the mainstream apostolic churches. For example, they tend to depend very heavily on signs, and they didn't quite come to terms with the deity of Christ. Therefore, they are not to be regarded as true believers. And so, when you look at chapter 6 of John, for example, the discourse of the bread of heaven and the way that the Jews ask for a sign, and Jesus responds to them, and eventually many of them leave him, you see. John supposedly here is trying to communicate something about Jewish Christians in his day that really are not up to par, theologically or otherwise, and they must not be considered part of the Christian world. Number three, you also have a group of what might be called crypto-Christians. Crypto-Christians. These are Jews who consider themselves Christians, but they're even worse than group two because they haven't even broken with the synagogue. Now, conceivably, Nicodemus could be viewed in this category, or although as I recall, Raymond Brown himself doesn't put Nicodemus in this category, but I think a lot of other scholars might, that Nicodemus really is a symbol for people who, for Jews who say they're Christians, but they don't want to make a, you know, much of a deal out of this publicly or otherwise. You know, I'm a secret Christian, and that's good enough for me, whatever. Fourth group is adherents of John the Baptist. Adherents of John the Baptist. These were people, disciples, who viewed John the Baptist as more important than Jesus. And you should know, if you're not already aware of this, that very many scholars view the early chapters of the Gospel of John, or certain passages in the early chapters of the Gospel of John, including the prologue, as being a polemic against too high a view of John the Baptist. And that makes pretty good sense, actually, you know, because why does the author make a point of saying in the prologue, he was not the light? Normally, you don't make a negative statement, except when you're trying to deny something that somebody believes or is suggesting. He was not the light, but he came to give witness of the light. And even more important, the development, the transition, you see, from John the Baptist to Jesus, and the disciples going from John to Jesus. And particularly, and this is climactic in that theme, when you get to the end of chapter 3, and John says, he must increase and I must decrease. That's the author communicating to John the Baptist disciples at the end of the first century that you ought to listen to John the Baptist. Stop paying so much attention to him and pay attention to Jesus. And of course, you know, we do have some partial evidence from the book of Acts, chapter 19, that indeed there may have been groups of people who identified themselves with John the Baptist and were separate from the Christian community more generally. The fifth group is the Jews. The Jews. And what a lot of controversy that label has caused. For a variety of reasons, particularly in the past couple of decades when there's so much concern about the Jewish-Christian dialogue and so on, and people who identify themselves with the Christian church are scurrying around trying to get around this problem of these sweeping condemnations of the Jews in the Gospel of John. And there are other problems, even apart from that particular issue of ecumenical dialogue between Christians and Jews, it's still kind of a conundrum why John uses such a broad label in a variety of passages when you can see contextually that sometimes it seems to mean only the Jewish leaders, for instance, or a particular group of Jewish people. And there are a number of modern scholars who argue very strongly that it is actually misleading to translate this term Judaioi as Jews, because John means something else. Maybe what he means is something like Judeans, see, the people who lived down there, and even that is not quite good enough. And just in the past couple of years, I've seen several articles in the journals and so on addressing that. It's a difficult exegetical problem, as well as a bit of a dilemma for translators. And the sixth group is the world. Now, the Jews, by the way, are a part of the world as well. But you have enough references to our cosmos to appreciate that more general category plays a part in the way in which John puts together the gospel. Let me just say parenthetically that in addition to this sort of thing, you cannot totally ignore other possible historical factors. For example, some scholars think that there is a Samaritan background to the Gospel of John, and we will address that question when we deal with chapter 4. Let's just leave it at that. The whole controversy about Gnostic or pre-Gnostic backgrounds, and Dodd in his book on the interpretation of the fourth gospel, you know, he spends a lot of time dealing with the Hermetic literature, trying to link certain kinds of concepts and so on. Now, again, I don't want to defend this sixfold division chart that Brown has. It is quite speculative and hypothetical, but it is not totally separate from textual evidence. I mean, it is very clear that that Brown and some of the other scholars that work along these lines have been trying to reconstruct the situation on the basis of textual data in the Gospel of John itself. And I think what we need to do is to take seriously the possibility that some of the material in the Gospel of John does reflect a situation contemporary to that of the author of the Gospel, and not think exclusively in terms of the situation contemporary with Christ, so that this twofold perspective really needs to inform what we're doing. And as I think I mentioned last time, I think Don Carson is quite right in his very critical assessment of some of these speculative exercises. But I don't think he's right in... he really does give the impression, as you come to the end of one of the sections in the introduction, he gives the impression that it is of no value whatsoever. I think that's incorrect. I think it does have some value, and it can enrich your exegetical study if you at least consider some of these issues as part of the total meaning of the text. Now, one important remaining question when you're dealing with the occasion for the writing of the Gospel is whether or not the Gospel of John was written to supplement the Synoptic Gospels. The view that John knew the Synoptics and used the Synoptics to some degree, that view was taken for granted throughout the history of interpretation as late as the first half of the century. But then there was a work produced by a fellow named Gardner whose work changed the picture dramatically, because he questioned very, very directly that assumption, and he tried to show that the evidence directed you to look in a different direction. When Barrett wrote the first edition of his commentary more than 30 years ago, he held out for at least some measure of literary dependence on Mark. But even though it was a rather minimal dependence. He has been something of a loner, really, in Johannine scholarship, in holding out for that kind of a connection. Now, I think, personally, that much of the debate has been vitiated, if you will, by the assumption that knowledge of is the same as literary dependence on. Knowledge of, in other words, whenever, well, that's too broad, but very frequently, when Johannine scholars talk about whether or not John knew the synoptics, it sooner or later becomes clear that what they really mean by that is, did John depend on the narrative of the synoptics to build his own gospel? And I think that is a gratuitous identification of phrases, and you want to be careful about that. Use the terms that you really mean. Do you really mean literary dependence? Use that phrase. Knowledge of, that's something different. The two elements need to be distinguished, and it's gratifying that some recent books have made that point. For example, Beasley Murray in his commentary on John is aware of the fact that you got to distinguish those two ideas, and Moody Smith in a relatively recent book, which I think is a collection of essays, also makes a similar point. What I would want to argue, and I think I want to argue this pretty strongly, is that no Christian community at the end of the first century would have been unaware of the synoptic tradition. It's just unreasonable to think that any Christian group in the Mediterranean world at the end of the first century would not have known the basic gospel story as it was transmitted by the synoptics. Now, I don't want to make more of this than is necessary. I would not be surprised, personally, if we were to determine that most Christians at the end of the first century were quite aware and maybe even familiar with the contents of all three synoptic gospels. But we don't have to go that far. We don't have to go that far. All I'm saying is that if there's any credibility whatever to the story of the book of Acts, and even the most skeptical critics would acknowledge that, you know, there's a lot of genuine historical material there. You have Peter preaching and John preaching, and they are obviously telling the stories about Jesus that were at some point brought together in the in Mark and Matthew and Luke. And remember, I brought up that question with regard to the problem of why isn't John mentioned in the Gospel of John. The sons of Zebedee, why aren't they mentioned? Is it really conceivable that any Christian at the end of the first century wouldn't have known that John, James, and Peter were the close disciples of Jesus? I don't think that's a reasonable assumption. You know, anything is possible, I guess, but it's just not reasonable. And I think it makes very little sense to conceive that whoever wrote the Gospel of John knew nothing about this gospel story, the kerygma, if you will, which would have included some of the basic elements in the narrative tradition that we have in all synoptic gospels. So what I would want to argue that whether or not John used Mark, you know, precisely, using that term precisely, I think it makes all the sense in the world to suggest that John may have wanted to provide information which was not found in that synoptic tradition. And again, I would want to go back to that comment by Eusebius, which I don't take that as gospel truth, but I think it is appropriate to say that John did want to give information about the early part of Jesus' ministry. You know, you remember that everything in chapters 2, 3, and 4 of the Gospel of John, except for the very last incident, are missing from the synoptics. And I think one can also argue that not only historically, but theologically, John supplements the synoptics by combining themes that are distinctive of those synoptic gospels. For example, the Spirit is a very important theme in the Gospel of Luke. The notion of fulfillment is very important in the Gospel of Matthew. I think Jesus' deity is important in the Gospel of Mark, and these various concerns are brought together in a more synthesized form in the Gospel of John. So I don't want to, you know, place undue emphasis on any on what may have been the specific relationship that may have obtained between John and the Synoptics, but I think we may legitimately assume some knowledge of the Synoptics and a desire to provide an additional perspective, additional information, whatever. And as I think I tried to suggest last time, I this is speculative, so but it makes sense to me that John, you know, was preaching the gospel. He had his distinctive approach. He had his own recollections, and in the course of time, it was became more and more difficult to separate the raw stories, if you will, from the particular expression with which John related them. And so when he actually sits down to write the gospel or dictate it or whatever, it is very distinctive and it looks quite different from the synoptics. But that doesn't mean he didn't know all those stories that you have in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. One thing that I'm not spending any time at all in class talking about the source critical theories about the Gospel of John. Carson, I think, has a very adequate treatment of that, and he probably refers to his own article, which he wrote at, it appeared in JBL quite a few years ago, in which one of his points was that when you take all of the major hypotheses trying to reconstruct the sources, the differences are so great that it casts suspicion on the whole endeavor. And I just wanted to make you aware of a book that appeared only a year or two ago, in case you're really an eager beaver and want to read 500 pages on source critical theory. But it includes, I haven't gone through it yet, I haven't checked out, so you wait a while. But it includes a fairly extensive historical survey of scholarship in this field, and then his own conclusions are quite negative. I mean, he comes to the point that, you know, they really haven't proven their case, specifically with regard to the sign source, and that's the title, the sign source in the fourth gospel. Subtitle is Historical Survey and Critical Evaluation of the Semeia Hypothesis. And the author is Gilbert Van Bell. This appeared in 1994. It's the Leuven University Press. It really is quite, I don't even know what adjective to use here, but when you see the effort and the time that has been spent on trying to figure out sources in the Gospel of John and where one begins and one ends and all this, I'm not saying that it has been 100% fruitless, but just the fact that I should even consider saying that tells you something. And so I don't think it's worth our while to spend too much time in class, but it doesn't mean that you can just ignore it. And it doesn't even mean, see, very frequently when people have attacked a problem trying to answer that sort of question, it leads them to treat certain passages exegetically in a way that really does shed light that would otherwise, you know, might otherwise have been missed. So this is often what happens. People are doing things that appear irrelevant, but in the course of doing that, it leads you to, it just opens up certain avenues of possibilities that otherwise might not come up at all. Well, not every detail was original. That synthetic picture was very original. But, you know, most of those particular themes that the gospel seems to be addressing in terms of some kind of, if not a discrete group, at least certain ideas that the author would have been interacting with, that had been around for a while. It's more the attempt to provide a complete picture, as complete as, you know, you can come up with, for what kind of a community would have created this gospel. Very little for most people, because chapter 21 is viewed almost universally as a chapter that was added onto the gospel at a later point. And so the thought is that you really can, it really sheds no significant light on the body of the gospel. Now, even conservative authors, conservative scholars of the Gospel of John acknowledge that chapter 21 certainly looks like an appendix of some type. But it does seem to me a little bit extreme to disregard totally, you know, what you have just pointed out, because even if this was added by somebody else, let's take an extreme position, whoever that person was would have been a lot more familiar with the Gospel of John than we are, I mean, with the circumstances and all of that. So it is very likely that what he's saying there reflects at least something of what the gospel as a whole was intended to provide. All six were there, I mean, it's always been recognized that the Gospel of John has a clear concern with reference to the Gentiles. And when Jesus speaks about having a sheep that belong to another flock, that usually has been understood in that light. But it would not necessarily be, you know, they might be included under this latter category of the world. But the fact that there are only two passages, and in fact only the one, because I think the earlier passage, isn't that a reference to the Jews in the diaspora who speak Greek? I think that's the way it often is taken. Right. So it would be primarily chapter 12, and I think everybody does give some significance to that, but I don't know that anybody would provide a specific category just for that, just to do justice to that statement. I wasn't saying that I think it was added. I'm saying, first of all, that among critics, it is almost taken for granted that this chapter comes from a different hand at a later point. The writing style is very different. You know, when you get to the end of chapter 20, that really looks like the end of the book, and then all of a sudden you come up with this stuff, you know. And then I went on to say that even conservative scholars acknowledge that there is something different about that chapter that may be viewed as an appendix. But if you view it as an appendix to the book, you're not necessarily committing yourself to saying that it wasn't by the same author. It may have been by the same author. Or it may have been by, you see, one common way of looking at this is, well, maybe now John has died. And now one of his disciples brings together some other things that John had said and puts them there. And one of the reasons why he needs to do that is that there was some tradition going around or some saying that John would never die. And that's why you have the little incident at the end. Peter says, well, what will happen to him? And then there's a clarification from the author. Now, Jesus didn't mean that he wasn't going to die. That's one way of reading it. But all right, let's talk about structure. The task of outlining a book, as I mentioned last week, shouldn't be seen as business of list, you know, a laundry list, if you will. simply giving a series of items that tell you a little bit about the content of the book. But rather, it should be an effort to place passages in their proper context. The connection of a statement to what precedes and what follows is always essential to good interpretation. So a good outline does not merely describe contents, but it reveals the progression of the argument. And even though, of course, we aim to approximate the author's own thought, you can have several different outlines which may be equally valid. Now, some of you have heard me talk about this before, but I still think it's a pretty good illustration. When I started teaching at Westmont College, Bob Gundry had a manuscript. It was actually his manuscript on his book on Soma and Biblical Theology. And, you know, I was a young fellow and he was trying to make me feel good or something. So he says, could I have your opinion on this book? And I thought he meant it. So I read it, and when I talked to him, I said, okay, you know, good book. I wonder if maybe you might want to rethink your table of contents, because he had, you know, 11 or 12 chapters. And I said to him, don't you think that you know, you could group them, it could help the reader if you group them together into three major parts, because you seem to be dealing with those three principal issues. One is a more lexical kind of thing, another one is theological, whatever. And he said, oh yeah, it's a good idea. And then when the book came out, opened it to the table of contents, and there was my outline. And it wasn't even a footnote acknowledging me. So when you see him next Friday, you ask him how'd that happen. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is this. People sometimes worry too much when they do an outline of a book of the Bible about whether the author had this outline in mind. Maybe he had a different outline in mind. Maybe he didn't have any clear-cut outline. When you produce an outline, you are trying to communicate what your understanding of the material is. You're not trying, primarily anyway, to reproduce the author's outline, whatever that might have been. Now, as I said, you don't want to completely ignore that, and if the author gives you some clues in the text that may seem to indicate divisions and so on, it would be a bad idea to ignore them. But the kind of outline that I'm talking about is really an interpretive tool. It is one way for you to, in your own words, in your own perspective, come up with, you know, just your understanding of what's going on in the gospel or in the epistle or whatever. And therefore, I think it's usually helpful to have relatively few major headings, because if you have few major headings, then you can see the basic building blocks of the material a little bit better, and see if in your subheadings you can phrase them in such a way that it helps whoever is looking at your outline see how something before connects with what is after, that kind of thing. Now, we're running out of time. I was going to ask you what sorts of things you had come up with, but let me just give you mine and let you ruminate. The first thing to keep in mind is that, as most scholars have seen, there does seem to be a fairly major division between the first 12 chapters and the rest of the book. And I am following that particular insight here. Everybody also seems to recognize that the prologue and the and chapter 21 are separate from the rest of the book. So as you can see from the outline, I have the introduction, chapter 1, all right? And at the end, the epilogue, chapter 21, right? And then I have these two major divisions. Jesus reveals his glory to the world, chapters 2 to 12, and then Jesus reveals his glory to the disciples. Now here you have only two major headings, they're phrased similarly, and they're supposed to indicate some kind of progression in the story, more or less public ministry of Jesus to something a little bit more private, if you will. The subdivisions, particularly under the first major part, I have leaned very heavily on Dodd's own understanding of the material. You notice these three subheadings: the New Order, chapters 2 through 4, the Life Giver, chapters 5 through 8, and then the world's unbelief. That's the way the world responds to Jesus, is with unbelief, chapters 9 through 12. And if you see on the other side, I also happen to have three subheadings. The one that really matters as far as showing this kind of progression is the third one, the disciples' faith. And I do think that's deliberate in the Gospel of John. The first part ends in a pessimistic note. In spite of all that Jesus did, the world just didn't believe in him. But the second part ends in a positive note, particularly chapter 20, as the disciples and even Thomas believes in him. That's part of what I'm talking about when I say, see if you can, in your outline, give some kind of indication of the way things relate or how the argument is developing. An issue that deserves attention is the observation that everybody has heard about probably, namely that in the first part, chapters 2 through 12, we seem to have seven signs. Now there's a little bit of controversy about that, because only six of them are actually called signs. There's the wedding in Cana. There's the so-called second sign at the end of chapter 4. The son of the official, the healing of the paralytic in chapter 5, the multiplication of the bread in the first part of chapter 6, the healing of the blind man in chapter 9, and the resurrection of Lazarus in chapter 11. Now that's six, but there does seem to be a recurring pattern of sevens, and which is the seventh? And here's where scholars disagree. Leon Morris thinks that the one that's missing is Jesus walking on the water in chapter 6, but hardly everybody agrees with that at all. Jesus' own resurrection? Well, yeah, but it isn't quite called that. There's a very recent article in the Bulletin for Biblical Research by a young fellow named Kestenberger. Andreas Kestenberger. It's entitled The Seventh Johannine Sign. The Seventh Johannine Sign, a study in John's Christology. And it is the Bulletin for Biblical Research. Volume 5 for 1995. You only have one issue a year. And Kestenberger argues that the only... He does believe that that 7 is an important consideration here, and he thinks that the only one that really fits the pattern would be the cleansing of the temple at the end of chapter 2. Well, when I did this outline, I was following primarily Morris, and that's why you see that interspersed throughout the outline, I have, see, first discourse, second discourse, first sign, second sign, third sign, and so on. I don't think it works to try to outline the book on the basis of these sevens, like, okay, I'm going to take the seven signs as the criterion for the outline. It just gets too mumbled, and you cannot really account for the material very well. Another factor which I found quite persuasive is Brown's emphasis, Raymond Brown's emphasis, number one, on the geographical points. And so I made that kind of a fundamental element in the earlier part here. You see that the next level of after the new order, you have Cana, Jerusalem, Samaria, Cana, then under the life giver, Jerusalem, Galilee, and Jerusalem. And I really think that this geographical movement is something of a clue in terms of how John is developing the story. And the other thing that I took from Brown was the emphasis on the Jewish feasts. And so you can see barely that I have these in bold. The Passover, Sabbath, another Passover, Tabernacles, Sabbath, Dedication, Passover. Again, I think it would be a mistake to make those a criterion for the actual, but to bring it out as part of the progression of the, and the meaning of the gospel makes sense as well. Well, I give this to you simply as a point of reference. I bring it to class because as we go through the material, I will try to justify some of these divisions and identifying blocks of text and where paragraphs end and begin is really a fairly significant thing to keep in mind when you're trying to do your exegesis, because it's just one more aspect of contextual interpretation. That's really what you're doing, putting things in the right context. Well, any questions about the structure of the Gospel of John, maybe on the basis of your own outline or anything related to that? Beats me. I think it is important for John to point out some of this work that Jesus was doing in Judea, that the other Judea and Samaria, that the other apostles, that the other gospels do not say anything about, and also Cana, the two events in Cana, the cleansing of the temple plus Nicodemus in Jerusalem, the woman in Samaria, that is important, and because the gospels, the synoptic gospels, spent virtually all their time with what Jesus was doing up in Galilee. All you hear about the Galilean ministry is what you find in chapter 6 of the Gospel of John. Everything else is in Jerusalem or the surrounding areas. That's what's important. But the actual name places, that's a little more difficult to try to...
She said there's so many.
Yeah. I doubt that it would be very different from any other historical material. I mean, if you pick up Josephus, you probably come up with 5,000. You know, so... Yeah. To use them for the outline?
Pardon?
To use them as a criterion for an outline?
For
Yeah, it might work. I mean, I don't know that I've actually seen an outline that tries to highlight those statements, but maybe it would. Well, one of the reasons I'm leaving the prologue to the end is to get a better appreciation for the degree to which the prologue is really setting the stage, anticipating themes, preparing the reader to understand the material in the body of the gospel in its proper context. Now, I'm not so sure whether on the base of the prologue you could come up with some sort of outline provided there, because I think that the prologue does anticipate the contents, but more in a thematic than in a structural sense. But you know, maybe something could be done with that as well. I'm not sure on whether it is textually correct. Yeah, when we get there, I may say something if you force me to. All right, for next time, remember you're supposed to prepare carefully chapter 1, verse 19 to the end of the chapter. You might want to go through the Greek or at least parts of the Greek a little bit more carefully than you would for purpose of the quiz. And primarily leaning on Carson. You don't have to read the whole thing. If you want to, that's great, but at least some extended sections. And sooner or later, and if you want to begin to do that this first week of this part of the course, to go to the reference shelves and pull out at least one other commentary and see what he has to say about three or four verses, to begin to get a feel for how these commentators are different from one another, which seem to you more helpful. And do take that seriously, because I think it's important in the course of the semester to build some kind of sense for what these resources can do for you as you then later prepare your primary, study, the passage that you're focusing on.